He found that 88% of what we are calling the effectiveness of medication is actually reduplicated by placebo. So what that means is that 12% of people are getting a benefit that they couldn't otherwise get from placebo, and all 88% are getting only risk.
Welcome to Betty Bites, a decidedly delicious, short and sweet mind snack for your brain to chew on. I've gone back into the Betty library and pulled out my favorite Betty sound bites, a recipe, you might say. It's bits of wisdom, sprinkles of knowledge, and a dash of dry humor for you to do and be better.
And I thought it might be a good place to start with the hypothesis around depression, the monoamine hypothesis around this chemical, or this, it's really a theory around the chemical imbalances in the brain. Can you explain what that is and how it is so pervasive and how we think about mental illness?
Yeah. So the sordid history of psychiatry's clamoring to be accepted and acknowledged as a valid medical discipline is probably more elaborate than we can get into now. But suffice it to say that, you know, in around the 1950s, there were a number of factors that sort of came together to give birth to this theory. One of them was observations around the way that patients behaved after they were treated for tuberculosis with medications that impacted, at least theoretically, what's called the monoamine pathway in the brain. And there was an observation that there was like transient euphoria in these individuals. And that plus a theoretical paper by a gentleman named Scheldkraut, plus minus some potential CIA co-opted research on psychedelics, gave birth to this opportunity for the pharmaceutical industry to leverage a really poorly baked biological concept and physiological mechanism around what might be driving different states of behavior, mood, and cognition, but in this case, specifically depression. And, you know, what follows is the multi-billion dollar industry of antidepressant drugs. And what happens is that in many cases, pharmaceutical science reverse engineers a theory, right? So it would be like, as my colleague David Healy says, when he uses the metaphor around alcohol as, you know, another representation of a consciousness altering substance, right? So if we were to do a trial of, you know, two shots of vodka for social anxiety, and we would have the participants take either that or water, you know, you could imagine that in an 8-week trial, there would be an effect, so that the participants might come out of that trial and say, you know, it really helped. I actually felt way calmer. Mm-hmm. And I didn't struggle with the social anxiety that cripples me every single day. But of course, we know logically that it would be an error to deduce from that those individuals have some sort of an alcohol imbalance or some sort of an ethanol deficiency, right? And we certainly know that if they were to repeatedly expose themselves to that kind of an intervention, that biochemically they'd be in a bit of a tough place if they wanted to discontinue said intervention a couple of decades later, right? So there have been many renegade psychiatrists before me, like Peter Breggin and Joanna Moncrief, who have been shouting from the rooftops about the fact that we can not call these medications by their mechanism, right? So the suggestion that this is an antidepressant in any way, that it is resolving a baseline known state of imbalance, is a fallacy. We can, alternatively, make the argument that there is a drug-based effect, okay? So not unlike alcohol, right?
Yes.
There's a drug-based effect. Now, that effect may be very adaptive for you, right? So if you start Paxil and it's sedative and you've been wired for, you know, 6 months, that may be exactly what you need. Or you have some of the stimulating effects of something like, you know, Effexor or Prozac, that may be a perfect fit for you. What they have in common, seemingly, is a certain kind of blunting right? Affective blunting, a kind of emotional blunting. And for many, to your original question, who do not have, I would argue this is all of us, but the experience to know how to sit with certain emotional states and to work with certain kinds of symptoms that are emerging, that could be highly preferable, right? So no one is suggesting that there isn't an effect. What many before me and you know, what I've kind of collected data to support is that this effect is not resolving a problem. It's creating a new normal.
Yes.
And if you happen to like that, that would be great if there weren't public health, in my opinion, public health consequences to the freedom to choose this medical intervention. While I am a huge believer in informed consent, and I would like to empower all people to make the best choice for them. And if you know the literature that suggests that the effect of antidepressants, when you control for the side effects, right, and all of the beliefs that are enacted because of our direct-to-consumer advertising culture, where we've been literally brainwashed to understand our own biology through big corporations who stand to profit from that understanding, right? So when we engage a medication we imagine might help us and we start to have side effects, something happens that's called the active placebo effect. This has been exquisitely researched by Irving Kirsch, who is arguably the placebo effect expert. And what he has suggested through very rigorous statistical analysis, including the invocation of unpublished literature conveniently tucked in the file drawer, right, that he accessed through the FOIA process, he found that 88% of what we are calling the effectiveness of medication is actually reduplicated by placebo. So what that means is that 12% of people are getting a benefit that they couldn't otherwise get from placebo, and all 88% are getting only risk. So this is something to consider, because we might say, okay, so what are the risks? What's the big deal? Who cares whether it's placebo or not? If it helps, it helps, right? That's a pragmatist perspective. But the risks that I have come upon, the two, you know, this is not the laundry list of, like, you know, interference with libido and menstrual cycles and GI bleeding and hair loss and rashes and all of that. The two that I want to shine a spotlight on, because I know too many people who wish that they knew about these before they, you know, waltz their first prescription to CVS. One is the propensity for these medications to seemingly randomly, although it's just that we don't know how yet to properly risk stratify yet, induce states of impulsive violence. Right. Yes. So whether this is a school shooting, or whether it's a pilot taking down an airplane, or whether it's hanging yourself from the rafters in your garage when you've never felt a moment of suicidality before you started taking that medication. The trouble is that you just don't know if you are going to be one of those people. And I have many citizen activists who have contacted me over the years, including David Carmichael, who had the experience of murdering his own 11-year-old son on a routine dose of Paxil for work-related stress. And he's not alone. This is not random. It's not rare even. So that Russian roulette is a pretty big one, right? Because in the state of intoxication, essentially, you actually can appear completely calm and normal to those around you. And meanwhile, you know, you're in this agitated, impulsive state of akathisia, often what's called, is a neurological term for the kind of state that can be induced. We think it has to do with the way certain people metabolize these medications that can lead to this intoxication state.
Yes.
But trust me, your primary care doctor is not screening you for those liver-based polymorphisms, right? So that's one. And the other is the potential for these medications to, I would say it's more than a potential, it's a likelihood, for these medications to induce a state of chemical dependency. Mm-hmm. This is not to speak to the psycho-spiritual dependency, you know, that emerges from an experience of understanding yourself as fundamentally sick and broken and understanding your emotional states as wrong, right? That is a whole other topic. This is literally just biochemical, right? And these medications, I've made this statement many times, I still stand by it. For 10 years, I have had a practice devoted to taking women off of these medications, and I believe that they are the most habit-forming chemicals on the planet that make Cigarettes and OxyContin and crack cocaine and alcohol look like a walk in the park to detox from, right? So I have never heard of a chemical that requires sometimes a thousandth of a milligram decrement per month in order to medically stably withdraw from. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of people on the internet right now telling their tales. And if that is a risk worth taking, at least you should know about the possibility, because the many, many, many patients that I started on medication in my tenure as a conventional prescribing psychiatrist, I never told a single one of them about this because I didn't know.
All right, Betty's, if you found that that little snippet whet your appetite and you are looking for more, you can go to our show notes for this episode. And in the show notes, we will have a link for you to click on, and it will bring you to the full, robust, juicy conversation.